World Cup, World Cup. Every 4 years it's the World Cup, World Cup. If you don't pick up a grunt straight in the build-up, then we'll love it when you score a goal.
Ooh, did you see that?
World Cup, World Cup. It might all end in tears or a headbutt. Headbutt. You can follow all the blogging on your laptop. From Slovenia to Slovakia, from Nigeria to the Cote d'Ivoire.
Ah, Cote d'Ivoire.
The Guardian and Observer, packed with World Cup coverage every day.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, Guardian Games editor Keith Stewart reports from the biggest computer games event of the year, talking us through the big announcements from the major players, the innovations from the indie scene, and the latest buzz from the people who were there. We'll also give you the details of a new scam that threatens to swindle 200 quid from British computer users. And we'll be asking whether the sale of Bebo at an enormous loss means that the once diverse and profitable social networking scene is now floundering under the weight of market leader Facebook. Joining me to debate these stories are Keith Stewart and Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both. Keith, now, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, also known as E3, takes place every year in LA.
Yes,
and you were there this year. Was this your first E3?
No, I've not actually been in for a long time, but no, it's not my first. It's about my fourth or fifth. So it's my first since it shrank down. When a few years ago, the industry went, hang on, this is ridiculously expensive. We've got to stop this. And then it shrank to a kind of a series of business meetings. And everyone, hang on, this is really boring and awful. Let's make it big again. And so last year was a bit bigger, and this year was even bigger still. So yeah, it's strange. It's actually growing again after a recession. So, but yeah.
Well, we'll talk more about E3 later. E3 is my idea of hell, I have to say. But just quickly, were there any gadgets that you saw people using? You know, any sort of must-have gadgets? Was everybody on an iPad, for example, or were they? You know, were they using?
There were a lot of iPads. Everyone was flashing iPads this year. In fact, there was almost no iPhones. It was iPads everywhere. When I was on the plane on the way out, all the journalists immediately were on there.
Oh, look at my iPad. Oh, look at mine. Oh, I cannot.
And I was testing a Google Android phone, so I was well out on a limb by myself.
You were an individual. That's
yeah,
what
exactly.
We like about.
Yeah,
who's
yeah.
the geeky guy?
Yeah.
Charles, now you've covered your fair share of conferences in the past, but you're kind of strapped to your desk now as technology editor. Are there any, though, that you feel that you would pay to, that are highlights of the technology event calendar every year that you think are absolute must-go-to events?
Well, Bobby Johnson always used to do the CES here in Las Vegas. And I have to say, I've been to CES in Las Vegas a long time ago. When they were just introducing DVDs, they said, hey, we've got this really great new technology. It's a DVD.
You're showing your age.
I am a DVD.
Well, we will be talking about E3 today, and we'll be talking about CES, of course, when CES comes around next year. But keep listening now over the next 30 minutes for the best technology news and commentary The Guardian has to offer. Here's this week's technology news. First up, the headlines over the past week have been dominated by announcements from the Electronic Entertainment Expo, held last week in Los Angeles. Now, E3 is the biggest trade and public computer games event in the English-speaking world. The Tokyo Game Show, for pedants, is the Japanese version of E3. And all of the big names and the big money descend in Los Angeles. I feel it's an absolute cacophony. It is an orgasm of the senses, and I avoid it like the plague. So I'm very glad that our special games envoy, Keith Stewart, went this year instead of me. Keith, what were the big headlines?
Okay, first of all, I don't think I'd be comfortable using the word orgasm in relation to E3.
Actually, that's a very good point.
And avoiding it.
Didn't they ban booth babes?
No, booth babes are still very much there. They're rarer now. They're almost a protected species. You're no longer allowed to hunt them. But yeah, they're still there. Yeah, the biggest thing absolutely definitely was Nintendo 3DS. Microsoft's big showing of Kinect on Sunday night was the most kind of hubristic thing I've ever seen in my life. It was Cirque du Soleil doing some kind of interpretation in dance and music of Kinect. It was profoundly ridiculous. And everyone that went in, we all had to put on these white kind of cloaks. I don't know what technology they were using, but basically these lights in the shoulders. And during the show, everyone's shoulders would light up in different colours. My it was wow. like being
and people say Apple is a cult.
Yeah, no, seriously, it was like being indoctrinated into Scientology or something. It was like Fern Gully meets the Scientologists.
And the technology. the show obviously got quite a lot of attention, but the technology.
Well, I mean, obviously, Kinect is really interesting as a completely hands-free way of interacting with video games. The journalists at the show were kind of in two minds about the whole thing. There's a lot of worries about lag. I didn't actually spot any lag issues myself. I only played like three or four of the games, but people were talking about lag and people were talking about the fact that all the games were very similar. It was either kind of multi-sport games or it was fitness games. There wasn't that much else that Microsoft was sharing.
Now, before we get too deeply into Microsoft, because we're going to be talking a lot more about what's now called Kinect, what used to be called Natal, a little bit later in the podcast, I want to jump back to the Nintendo DS 3D. Because what's interesting about the games industry is that games companies are starting to converge around Los Angeles. Because the film industry and the games industry, they're really interacting in terms of the technologies that they use, the techniques that they use, and perhaps the gimmicks that they use. Obviously, what we're seeing in the cinemas at the minute is 3D. Is this a gimmick for Nintendo? Is this what? Tell me more about the DS 3D.
Yeah, well, the Nintendo 3DS is a new version of the Nintendo DS with obviously a 3D screen, so you can see 3D visuals without any glasses, which is quite interesting technology. Nintendo, on the usual thing, they've used off-the-shelf technology, I think, for this. So I suspect it's a very similar technology as what we've seen in mobile phones and laptops in the Far East, in Korea and Japan. And it also takes 3D photographs as well, which is interesting. It's got two lenses on the back, and you can take photographs of your friends and then calibrate them to their 3D. So lots of interesting angles there. But actually, 3DS was really only part of Nintendo's offering this year, and they've brought back lots and lots of really famous games like Zelda and Kirby. It seems as if there's been a masses of preparation into their event this year. So I spoke to one of their American product managers, Daniel Ray Willer, and asked him about Nintendo's preparations for E3 and some of the highlights of what they had on offer.
We've been playing it for a while, or at least for most of this year so far, and if not even earlier for the actual games themselves, but just preparing to get ready for this conference itself, it's been a long time planning.
What were some of the games you're looking at and involved with and interested in?
Kid Icarus Uprising looked amazing on there. Seeing Nintendogs, which we have up here as well. Legend of Zelda Skyward Sword has been amazing. Donkey Kong Country Returns, I'm a huge fan of that from back in the day. And then Kirby, I mean, Kirby's Epic Yarn.
One of the interesting things with it is, with what I've seen, is there are lots of classic games, and sometimes when that happens, you think, oh my god, not the same games again. But they seem to have taken every single one and done something really quite unique with it. I mean, Kirby was a standout example for me. I absolutely loved the look of that. It was beautiful. I mean, is that kind of, do you think that's the theme of what Nintendo's doing at the moment, of taking the sort of classic stuff we all know, then really kind of changing it for a sort of a new generation, I guess, of gamers?
Yes. Well, that's something we definitely work towards. It's always taking the classic. We have such a huge library of characters, which always gives us advantage to take these characters and bring them back to life in different ways. Kid Icarus Uprising is a great example of that. I know people have been waiting to see that and asking for it, and we finally brought that out here, and it's going to be going on the Nintendo 3DS, which is great. And even taking advantage of games like Donkey Kong Country Returns, it has that same feel, but you can tell it's something different. It's always evolving, taking advantage of what the hardware can do with the Wii, the Nintendo 3DS, or even on the DS side itself, taking a game like Dragon Quest IX, which is a classic title that has many iterations, that's coming there. Golden Sun is another one that's finally brought back. You've been waiting for that one to see how the story develops from where it ended. So it's always keeping track of. Now we have three pieces of hardware to work with, so it's really adding a lot more for us to work around.
And do you think for the last couple of years, Nintendo has kind of been far away from its competitors, but now Microsoft and Sony are really trying to claw their way back with their PlayStation Move and with the Microsoft Kinect. Do you think Nintendo feels more pressure, or do you think it again has got its own agenda which it's sticking to?
We're always looking at our agenda. We find it great when people try to follow along what we're doing, but we're always pushing and see what we can create, what we think is a great way for gamers to have different experiences. We're not really always competing or like worrying about what other people are thinking. We like being innovative and seeing what we can create and bringing enjoyment to different people in different ways, and that's what we kind of look toward.
That was Daniel Ray Weller from Nintendo speaking with Keith at E3, and it sounds like it was pretty loud there on the floor, Keith.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was immediately after the press conference, and you've never seen so many people running to grab hold of small consoles in your life. It was a scrum.
So does it work? You did actually get your hands on the machine.
Yeah, yeah. I had a play. They were only showing rolling demos at the time, but I saw Resident Evil and Metal Gear Solid, and it looked lovely. The graphics, I would say, were probably somewhere between Nintendo DS and sort of Wii. Some the sort of half point between there, but yeah, the fact you can move the camera around, and there was a scene where Solid Snake from Metal Gear Solid's kind of walking along a rope bridge, and you can move the camera all the way around him. And I explained it in the blog to say he looked like a little Games Workshop painted figurine because the sort of 3D representation was so effective. So it was lovely. It was really nice. And whether it's a gimmick or not is almost beside the point because it works so well. And also the important thing, obviously, it's glasses free as well. You don't have to wear glasses for it.
Charles, do you think that the real killer app for 3D is going to be in the video games space?
I think that for home use, for people trying to decide whether they want to have a television which has some sort of 3D capability, I think there'll be two things. The first one will be for sport, because sport, if you can do 3D sport, then that gets really good. And, people really can get a lot out of that. You know, it's the extra dimension. But I think also that for gaming, if you get games which are written for it, which will downgrade gracefully so that you don't have to have a 3D TV in order to play it, but if you do have a 3D TV, then it does it, then yes, that'll work. But the difficult thing is going to be that graceful downgrading and making sure that it does work with both the old and the new.
We'll have more on the big headlines from E3 later on in the podcast. Also this week, America Online offloaded the kids' social networking site Bebo at an enormous loss. They bought the company for $850 million in 2008, but sold it this week for less than $10 million. Charles, what are the details of this sale?
Well, having bought Bebo for this marvellous $850 million, which rather echoes the purchase of MySpace in 2005 by the by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation for north of $500 million, AOL offloaded it to private equity group Criterion Capital Partners, and it's reckoned it could be anywhere between $2.5 million and $10 million that it was sold for. Criterion said that Bebo remains attractive as both, quote, a standalone entity and in the context of our broader investment objectives. I mean, the thing is that as given what AOL had paid for it, Bebo just wasn't going anywhere, and it just didn't make any sense for them. But you can see that Criterion, as a private equity company, and typically what they do is they get the company that they bought to focus on what it is good at and really just strip everything else out and turn it around, make it profitable, and turn it into something they can sell on.
One of the things about the social networks, the enormous sums that people were paying for them, is this user base, is this idea that, here you go, you've got this enormous database of people that you can then, exploit in whatever marketing ways that you want to. Have the kids left Bebo? Have they gone to Facebook? Have they gone somewhere else? Are they no longer interested in online social networks? Where is the audience? Or is it some other reason why the price went down so much?
Well, the price went down because AOL just couldn't support Bebo because it was losing people. People are going from Bebo, growing up basically, and going off to use Facebook. I think the growth of Facebook and the fall off in MySpace and Bebo indicates just what's happened. It's not that people have stopped using social networking; it's that they're not using those two. But there's still a sort of hardcore of people, around about 20 million who still use Bebo pretty regularly, and you can see that for Criterion that it sort of $2.5 million or $10 million outlay, actually that's not a bad price. That's the sort of price that you could almost imagine AOL should have paid in the first place. What they were paying for, what they thought they were paying for was the sort of, the potential in the future. Facebook came along and just upset that all. But now Criterion, could make a go of it. You don't have to be big as a social network to be profitable and to be successful. All you have to be is something that people come to where you have a core of people who come to use the site regularly and who are prepared to, who are a target for advertisers or who will pay for things on it.
Absolutely. It has to be effective. It has to be very focused. But surely this was one of the problems of Bebo, because they focused on the youth market. And of course, this youth market is going to grow up. I mean, did they shoot themselves in the foot?
If your core message is, hey, it's cool, it's only people who are under 16, then yes, you have a pretty limited group of people to grow from. But I suspect that Bebo is going to reinvent itself in the next couple of years. And it's just going to get used to living small.
Well, do let us know your experiences of Bebo and which social networks you prefer. Get in touch on Twitter, yes, a social network, at GuardianTW. Finally, Charles, you've been looking into a story about a new scam that takes advantage of people with computer problems. What's the story?
Well, it's actually people who don't have computer problems. But what happens is that people get a call out of the blue from people who say that they've received a message. That is the person calling up, says, hello, we're online support. We sort of work with Microsoft. We've received a message from your ISP that your computer has a virus and we need to fix it for you. And they then direct people to a website to download a piece of software which will give them control over the computer and will let them, they say, first find the viruses and then to get rid of the viruses. And for this, they will charge you £185 or so. Websites that have been found to be involved in this include f1compstep.uk.com, which has actually been closed now by HostGator, which was its host, thesupportonline.com, and thenerdsupport.com. But what I'm very interested in, and I'd really appreciate help from listeners on this, is to find someone who's had this scam happen to them. If they've paid out, I'd be really interested to know what is the name of the company that appears on the credit card or debit card bill, because it is a scam. There's nothing wrong with your computer, and they really can't fix it remotely. Your ISP will not have called them. Microsoft will not have called them. They are cold calling people, possibly just on lists that they bought from some source or other. But in order to take this story a bit further, I do need to know what the name of the company is that appears against the bill, because if we know the name of the company, we can track them down.
And your email address is charles.arthur@guardian.co.uk. And you can also get in touch with Charles at Charles Arthur on Twitter.
That's it.
Keep up with the latest on all these stories and other technology news headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. Keith, let's find out more on the main stories from E3. First up, last week we mentioned that the motion capture camera for the Xbox 360 received a name change to Microsoft Kinect. Keith, what else do we now know about the device?
All we know that's new is some of the games that are supporting the device and some of the publishers that are bringing out games for it. So things like Dance Central, which is the makers of Rock Band, Harmonix have created a dance game for it, which you have to, it's not just one of those, you know, those old dance games where you had to just do hop, skip and jump on a mat. It kind of senses your whole body movement now and it teaches you moves and you can do like little routines and things like that, which is quite good fun. Kinectimals, which is a kind of pet 3D pet game where you have a little tiger on screen and you have to pet it by moving your hand around in a kind of vaguely petting way.
I can see where this is
absolutely
going.
Absolutely. Thrilling stuff. And also you can make it sad by hiding behind the sofa as well, so it thinks you've gone away.
Charles, you had quite a good question before.
I was wondering why it is that Microsoft changes the names of things like this. You know, we had all pretty much got used to the idea of it being called Natal, and I thought Natal was, you know, a pretty good name.
I think it was, and I honestly don't know. And the problem was, a lot of journalists, when we came out, we were all calling it Kinetic. In fact, I filed a story about it to the paper that night and then had to email them later on to tell them I've called it Kinetic all the way through and you've got to change it.
Which is, of course, the Sony property that deals with their eye. Their eye can as well. They've
but
got
just,
iToy Kinetic.
Kinect sounds quite toyish. I mean, there is a toy called Kinect, and Natal sounded kind of mysterious and vague and meaningful without actually meaning anything. So I honestly don't know why they've decided they had to change it, but I'm sure they probably spent a lot of money doing so.
The games you mentioned don't sound too dissimilar from the games that came out for the iToy, for the Sony iToy, on their PlayStation. And so I'm wondering, you know, they seem to be reinventing the wheel. Is there anything new about this? Why, Keith? Why?
Why, in the name of God, why? There's been a lot of stuff to say, oh, it senses, it can recognise faces and emotions, which I believe is probably taking it a bit far. I've spoken to some people that have developed for the technology and they say the camera isn't high resolution enough to pick up facial
that, That's a relief, actually. Yeah. Sort of them watching you through your TV.
Exactly. Jeez, so it's not going to start going, Dave, Dave.
Well, you mentioned some of the developers who are already starting to play around with this tech. Are there any developers that you think we should keep an eye on who would do something innovative, who would do something interesting with this technology, who've done perhaps something interesting in the past that we should watch for to do something interesting with Microsoft Kinect?
Microsoft have used a few small developers. They've used Rare. Now, Rare are interesting because they've obviously been involved with technology like this for years. Rare's a vintage British developer who worked on a lot of games and they helped with the whole Avatar setup with Microsoft. And
they did a series of really successful games, Perfect Dark, GoldenEye, yeah. Those types of games.
Yes, but now they're kind of working very closely with Microsoft and this technology. And if there's going to be any, I think there's going to be anything really, really interesting over the next year. It's probably going to come from Rare because they've worked with the technology for a long time. There may be stuff that comes from the outfield as well. Ubisoft has got a game called Child of Eden, which is by Tetsuya Mizuguchi, who is a famous Sega designer. He made a game called Rez on the Dreamcast, and in a way Child of Eden is kind of a version of that. It's a kind of dance music rhythm action game which you control with your hands. The game looks incredible as well. And it's totally unlike anything else that's on Move.
Well, you mentioned out of left field, you mentioned the indies, and generically what I've found just looking at the games industry over the past few years, that it is the indies who come up with the most interesting things. Did you see anything interesting coming out of that space? Was there a big indie presence at E3 this year?
I wouldn't say there was an enormous indie presence at E3, but there never is. What you tend to get are indie games which have crossed over into the mainstream and are now being looked after by big publishers. EA famously recently just signed two indie-made games, Death's Bank and Shank, which are both going on Xbox Live. So you're getting a lot of publishers who are very much looking at the indie scene and kind of cherry-picking stuff. But also on the show floor, there's the Indiecade Festival. Indiecade is actually a festival in its own right, but they also have a kind of a roving festival which goes out to different events, and they get sort of seven or eight games which have been submitted to the Indiecade and take them around and take them to places like E3. So I think right next to right behind the Sony stand, there was the Indiecade place, which looked like a university programming lab, because it was just a bunch of PCs on desks with loads of soda cans everywhere, and it was like this little development studio grafted into the middle of E3. So while I was there at Indiecade, I got a chance to speak to the festival director, Sam Roberts, and he was telling me about the work he does with Indiecade and why it differs from other games events around the world.
Our major festival, which is October every year in Culver City, California, is entirely public-facing. And the idea there is that allows us to show the entire breadth of the independent scene. We're not restricted to digital. We will show tabletop games, board games. We'll show live gameplay, street games. And also, I don't believe that all these games are necessarily just interesting to traditional game audiences or necessarily exist for traditional game platforms. I in fact think that a lot of what we don't think of as the gamer audience or the game playing audience really enjoys and can interface with these games that get a little less attention from the traditional game crowd because they're not interested in them. The general public really likes some of the very approachable, unique, different, innovative experiences that we tend to show. So we have this public-facing festival where we bring these games in and we try to share them with the public at large. We also then do showcases here at E3. We do one in Nottingham at Game City every year. And those are, rather than judged and juried, like our festival is, from a huge breadth of content. They're curated. We try to select games that are more specifically focused for the audience we're showing with, that people there will sort of be interested in. And the value for us of being there is they serve to introduce innovation and new ideas to the industry, right? You know, a huge AAA game costs $20 million. You can't experiment. If you spend $50,000 on your game, you can try something totally wild and new. And indie developers have that freedom and flexibility, and those ideas are really valuable to the industry and deserve to be shown at places like the Game Developers Conference and E3.
Can you tell me about some of the key games you brought here to E3 today?
We're showing a game called Malm, which is a master's thesis project from USC. What's really neat about it to me is it uses a brain-computer interface and a gestural interface, which are very non-traditional sort of gaming interfaces, to explore what is in a completely non-traditional gaming environment with non-traditional graphics and audio cues. The game is built off biofeedback. But so you settle in, and instantly you're being assaulted by things that are unfamiliar and strange in this environment, which sort of raises your personal stress levels and things like that, and the game starts responding to that. It creates a very quick, fast feedback loop where you're immediately unsettled. And it's really effective that. I think it's really interesting. The game itself isn't yet a fully built game, but conceptually how it works and sort of how it is assembled is really interesting for that idea. It's introducing sort of a new idea. Likewise, we're showing a game over there called Smart Kobold, which is an ASCII-based roguelike. This isn't a game that anyone in the game industry is going to pick up and distribute. The developer didn't make it to sell, but what he did make it for is to explore enemy AI and difficulty in games, which has been a big conversation the last year, right, with Demon's Souls and some of these games. So he built a roguelike that only has the weakest possible roguelike monster, the kobold. But those kobolds are really, really smart, and they defend their territory intelligently and using tactical plans, which makes the game incredibly difficult. And the creator, Jeff Lates, idea was that he would do this and would be excited to watch sort of the tension that existed between people who wanted to play the game but couldn't enjoy it because it was too hard. He was wrong. The roguelike community ate it right up, beat it, and loved it. So, you know, what does that say about difficulty in games? But again, that is something I think is interesting to the industry here at E3. It's why we brought it.
Is there any kind of crossover with the rest of the industry? I mean, do you get execs coming over from the really, really big stands and coming to see you? And have there been any stories of kind of successes or developments from that?
Yeah, we do get people from sort of all over the industry coming by and checking the booth. It's become a pretty regular stop for people working at XBLA and PSN and Nintendo to sort of check out new independent titles. One of my favorite stories is The Misadventures of PB Winterbottom. It's an XBLA game that came out last year. We showed it 3 years ago at E3, where because it was sort of present with all these other big mainstream games and presented in a much similar way, people actually were looking at it and paying attention and really enjoying it. Those guys met a bunch of contacts there that they worked with over the next 3 months and followed up, you know, with festival appearances and stuff and managed to get a contract to produce that game for Xbox Live Arcade. I do think that our E3 showcase and all of and our festival and our other showcases can really help a developer in that way. You don't only have to go to IGF to sort of meet the industry and get your game picked up that way. But it's been interesting the last few years. For a while, you would get software guys, or publishers, right? Activision comes, or EA comes. And now we see much more interest from actual hardware manufacturers, not just the big three, but people looking at alternate hardware platforms, people putting together, you know, mini shops of their own on the Android market, or trying to collect a bunch of neat indie games to present under the same label on iPhone. And it's things like this where actually you get people coming in and really approaching indie developers. It's been really neat to see. There's been a focus, interestingly, in the industry the last few years on enabling low-cost development, which is feeding back into a real explosion of low-cost development and of new independent developers.
Sam Roberts from Indiecade at E3. Now, Keith, indie games, the place where you say the stand is, right next to the Sony stand, is a pretty darn good location for an indie space. Was it populated or was it kind of sidelined?
I wouldn't say people were rushing to Indiecade. The interesting thing is, though, the important thing for Indiecade while they're there is to catch the attention of the actual publishers. When I spoke to publishers about Indiecade, they said that they definitely went and saw it. In fact, I spoke to Rod Humble, who's pretty much the head of the Sims division at EA, and he said first place he went when he got to the show was Indiecade, because that's where they're going to find, not only pick up really great developers, but also really, really great ideas as well, and some stuff that you just will not find in a modern studio.
Anyway, who else did you meet when you were at E3?
I got chance to meet with a lot of the head people at several studios. EA Games, EA, I spoke to quite a bit, and I met Frank Gibau, who's the president of the EA Game Studio there. And I talked to him a little bit about what EA hopes to get out of going to E3, and he was remarkably candid.
We are going for maximum quality games, epic adventures, and connected gameplay. And I think in each of the cases, like Medal of Honor or Dead Space 2 or Need for Speed Hot Pursuit, we hit each one of those beats. High quality, great online, and epic adventures.
There's lots of kind of familiar brands. What do you do with those brands? I mean, with Need for Speed, with Dead Space, we know those games quite well. And do you go in as a studio head and say, right, these are the grand criteria that you need to do for a sequel? Are you kind of prescriptive like that?
Initially, I don't put any constraints on them. I want to see what kind of crazy ideas and wild ideas come up, because then it's easier to edit them down as opposed to coming in with too many constraints. That will limit the thinking and get people to be more defensive about the idea as opposed to just being really exploratory. So we typically are very wide open. When we talk to Criterion, basically didn't give them any ground rules. We basically said, you've got the Need for Speed brand. What do you think it is? And you know, they came back with some really compelling pitches. Same thing with Medal of Honor. If we said, if we were going to reboot the Medal of Honor franchise, where would you go? What would you do? What would the stories you do? When they came back with the ideas, then we start to inject some of the ideas about, well, do we have the brand permission to do that, or do people think that that's too far? And in both cases, we actually were more aggressive about pushing the envelope on those franchises than not, because you get expected and people start to lose interest if you don't try and surprise them and be fresh with it.
And what do you think of E3 as a way of showing off games? Because we're all supposed to think of it as this enormous, incredibly exciting event. But for publishers, it must be a nightmare of trying to not only reach an enormous group of journalists from all over the world, but also try and get across to them how good your game is in seconds while you're surrounded by others. What's it like for you, E3? Is it exciting, or is it a horrible nightmare?
I think it's exciting. Frankly, E3 is a lot like what customers do. Customers only have a few seconds sometimes to make a decision about a game or whether they're going to be interested in your game. So I think that what's interesting about E3 is it's a bit of a test. It's a beauty contest to see how you're going to do this fall and what's working and what's not, and try and make adjustments coming out of the show. Well, hey, that message didn't work too well with this game, or this one really did. And you can start to double down on the hits and start to make changes to the ones that didn't quite hit their optimal. Personally, my favorite part of game development is getting it into people's hands and getting the reaction to see if we're onto something or to see if we have to change something. And so from my perspective, I'm pretty excited about E3, and I think it's a great platform for us to do better games.
Is it difficult for you in a way, because the people that are here tend to be the really, really hardcore writers? I mean, you look around the show and these are people that are live blogging almost every second of the day and tweeting from every single moment. Are those guys representative, do you think, of your audience at EA Games? Or do you have to almost take what they're saying and what they're doing with a slight kind of pinch of salt in terms of your overall audience?
I think they're a key part of the audience. So I think if you can satisfy them, then you're running downhill. If you can't convince the hardcore that you're onto something big, then it's going to be tough the way through. Because what happens when you convert those folks, if they really believe what you're saying and they see it and they play it and they're fired up as fans, they help you sell the idea to the rest of the market, the rest of the mass market. So from our perspective, our mantra is the core and more. And if you can't win the core, it's really hard to get to the more in our category.
Do you get a chance to kind of look around the show floor much? And if so, do you ever kind of spot stuff and think, oh my God, we should be doing that? Or thank goodness we're doing what we're doing.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think good competitive analysis is absolutely vital for what we do. The reason I'm at this company is I love making games and I love playing games. And so to go around and play the newest Killzone or check out the new Gran Turismo build, that's exciting for me on a fan level, but it's also on a business level. You can see things that they're doing that you might want to steal and maybe put in your game. Or you definitely see places where you're better than they are and you want to double down on that advantage, because ultimately you're competing with them.
That was Frank Gibeau from EA Games, being, as you say, Keith, remarkably candid, which seems to be...
stealing ideas.
I know. Well, it seems to be... Remarkably candid seems to be the new motto at EA since John Riticello, who's the CEO, I believe, joined the company and is remarkably outspoken himself, isn't he?
I think they've had a big corporate change at EA over the last sort of 3 years. And I think they've kind of almost been freed up by the fact that Activision have almost become the number one company in the industry now, and Bobby Kotick there, the CEO, has kind of become the pantomime villain of the industry, and EA have almost become, well, we're second now, we've got to catch up. And I think it's almost been liberating for them, and they've really kind of tried to reinvent themselves.
Down with corporate speak, I guess. Mm. Well, taking a broader look again, E3 is usually a hyper race between the three main platform holders: Nintendo, Microsoft, and Sony. Now, we've heard a lot about Microsoft, we've heard a lot about Nintendo in this podcast. What about Sony? Have they done anything? Thing, or oops, have they fallen off the planet?
Well, it was a weird one for Sony. They had an interesting kind of almost tetchy conference, almost kind of defensive. All they had really was the PlayStation Move announcement that's coming out in September. They had Portal 2, which was actually quite big. They had Valve come on stage to say Portal 2 is coming to PlayStation. Valve have previously said, we're never going to develop for PlayStation, we don't like it, it's a terrible machine. They've come on and gone, actually, yeah, it's all right. Sorry,
Sony.
A
coup, isn't it? Because they were always an Xbox platform.
PC as well, yeah. But they're very much, yeah, anti PlayStation. But now they're on board and Portal 2's coming to PlayStation. They had Gran Turismo 5. They announced the US release date, November 2nd, but they haven't released... they haven't announced anywhere else, so Lord knows when we're getting it. And Twisted Metal as well is an old car smash 'em up game license from the PlayStation, which is coming back. So it was a lot of things for fans. Killzone 3 as well is coming. It was more for kind of Sony fanboys, really. I don't think they were as strong as... They weren't as hubristic as Microsoft, and they didn't have a strong lineup like Nintendo's. It was a kind of an okay showing, I think, for Sony.
What was the sense that you got on the floor from the other attendees, from the other people who were at E3?
When they're writing about E3, a lot of the journalists would say, it's an amazing show, there's so much to see. But then when you actually talk to them, there's a lot of, oh God, it's the same old stuff, we're hearing the same old things.
Now, you spoke with a couple of journalists, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I wanted to try and get an angle from specialists, games press, about what they thought of the show and what it's like covering a modern show for a modern games outlet, because it's all so fast nowadays. So I spoke to Guy Cocker and Jane Douglas, and I wanted to find out from them what they'd seen and what they'd enjoyed at the show.
The 3DS is spectacularly impressive. I mean, it's one of those things where you see it and you're kind of surprised that you haven't seen it before done by someone else, but you've got to remember that Nintendo innovates in this area. You know, the touchscreen technology was still quite new when it was unveiled on the DS. And so I was just amazed at like how well the games played without the need for glasses.
Yeah, I think hardware-wise, the 3DS really is the winner here. I saw Child of Eden yesterday or the day before, which was amazing. I spoke to Mizuguchi, who made Rez and made Luminaires, and that was fantastic. It's really, really spectacular. It's really transcendental almost, like really, it's this really crisp, like 60 frames per second, luminous HD musical, well, Rumble, because he was playing on the controller rather than the Kinect at that point, experience that I wasn't... That's the one game I didn't already know about being at E3 that I've really enjoyed seeing, I suppose, yeah.
What is it, though? I still don't know.
So, well, okay, it's a synesthesia shooter.
That's what he calls it,
synesthesia. Yeah. No, he's still calling it, like, synesthesia, because he you know, music equals visuals equals Rumble, you know, all kind of integrated. It's an on-rails shooter.
Right,
but that sounds so prosaic that it doesn't really capture it, so, yeah.
Okay. I was going to ask you both how kind of social networking has changed the experience of reporting on E3, because you've got instant access to the material and you're in competition with other sites. So, I mean, what's that been like as a journalist, having that constant time pressure?
Well, it's really interesting. So, you know, you on the internet, you know, if you're not first, you're effectively, you know, last. There's no point doing it, right? So, you know, we race around and try and get impressions of the biggest games. And the industry has kind of responded to that by doing pre-E3 events where we see games ahead of the show itself. You know, we did an exclusive for Need for Speed, so we saw that, you know, 3 weeks before it actually came out. But like you say, you know, the blogs are really big now, and those news outlets of people getting news instantaneously is really interesting. You know, we've integrated Twitter into our live show a lot. But I was doing an impressions piece of Gears from the Microsoft event, and, you know, I thought I'd seen something, and I went on Twitter, and someone had put, like, you know, just confirmed what I thought I'd seen. So it's an interesting thing for a journalist, you know, like, you know, whether you don't feel redundant, but you're almost like, I think it's our job for us to kind of add a little bit of perspective to it and actually, you know, report on things in a... Ask the questions that, you know, that you need to ask of the high-level staff. I was trying to find out today whether Milo and Kate had been canned, and of course, you know, the execs don't really want to answer that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's you know, it changes every year, and you know, Twitter is really big in the games industry.
Jane, what's it like being a woman at E3, considering the enormous amount of booth babes everywhere and that whole kind of booth babe culture, which has been in part of E3 for like 15 years since it began, and also the fact that, you know, it's massively male dominated still. Is it for you reporting on the industry and being here, is it like you're completely comfortable with it, do you accept it, or are there things you wish would kind of change about it?
I don't see it changing in the very near future. I think that's a shame, and I think it's strange when you look at the move towards casual, or at least how huge casual really is. And, you know, the stats endlessly coming out saying You know, this proportion of gamers are female, and inevitably they're the ones playing, you know, that maybe the sports games or the fitness games, you know, in part, not entirely, but a large quantity are. That said, whoever's playing the games, the people who are watching E3 and the people who are attending E3 are, yeah, majority hardcore gamers who are majority male, yeah. It can be a tiny bit alienating, I suppose, in that you they're obviously not there for your benefit as a female. Interacting with them can be, for me, a little strange as well, because I don't get it, I suppose. But, you know, if they know what they're talking about, if they know the product, then no problem, fine, that's great. I had a really good demo from, I think they were Fragdolls on the Ubisoft booth. And they, you know, they were really nice, really, really amiable. Otherwise, it's no big deal, really.
I haven't seen that many booth babes on the show floor this year, which is a good thing, right?
I mean, I think there's less this year, but I've definitely, you know, they're definitely around, yeah.
Yeah. They're still a part of the glitz and glamour. I mean, E3, as much as it's an event for the games industry, it's also an event for the mainstream press, which is why you're here, Keith, I would imagine. So, you know, it's I kind of wince a little bit when I come into the main hall and see, you know, someone getting their head ripped off on a Mortal Kombat poster. Because that, you know, a lot of the industry, a lot of non-industry people come in and see E3 and, you know, the guys, whatever it is, New York Times or whatever, see this as what's going to happen in games for the next year. So it's a good thing that it's not all booth babes and loud music.
Guy Cocker and Jane Douglas from GameSpot. And you can read all the coverage on E3 at guardian.co.uk/technology/E3. Bing, 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 bing. Well, that's all for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Keith Stewart and Charles Arthur. Next week, Charles will be speaking with the CEO, the infant CEO, as far as I'm aware, of search company Timp. Find out why next week. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.